Right now, we have a system where large public companies have one set of disclosure rules. Smaller issuers have a scaled down disclosure requirement. Typically, that's three executive officers, CEO, CFO, and then the next highest paid executive gets put into their tables. Is that going to be lifted up and made standard for all companies? And then for the smaller companies, is it just CEO, CFO? I could see them doing something like that to make it more streamlined.
Executive compensation shapes more than pay. It shapes performance, culture, and leadership. Welcome to the Executive Compensation Podcast, where we unpack the strategies and insights that define today's boardroom decisions. Brought to you by Meridian Compensation Partners, LLC, trusted advisors to boards and management teams, navigating the complex world of executive pay and governance.
Welcome to the Executive Compensation Podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Harvey, and on this episode, I'm joined by Ed Howder. Ed co-leads Meridian's governance and regulatory team. Ed, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Ryan.
So on this episode, we're going to discuss some of the key issues facing compensation committees in 2026. 2026 is shaping up to be a pivotal year for executive pay. The SEC seems poised to make some of the most significant changes to the proxy disclosure rules that we've seen in nearly 20 years. And additionally, the proxy advisors have come under increasing pressure from both the federal and state governments and recently have announced a number of policy changes for 2026, and many of which are going to have a pretty material impact, I think, on how some committees consider executive pay in the year. So, Ed, maybe we can start with just thinking back over the past year here and the steps the SEC has taken, the roundtable and whatnot. Maybe remind our listeners kind of where we've come and where we are right now.
Well, let's not forget new administration for the U.S. government, which has led to a new administration and leadership in the SEC. So the SEC, sort of out of the blue in June, held a roundtable on executive compensation disclosure. They had multiple speakers from both industry, investors, outside advisors, all sitting in and talking about the disclosure rules as they exist today. Now, to remind everyone, the disclosure rules as we have them today came into being largely around 2006 with the last revamp of the proxy disclosure rules. The SEC chair has made comments about the rules not necessarily being simple enough. They're somewhat bloated disclosures many companies are putting out there. And in large part, that's due to the requirements that people are reading into it and some of the expectations of shareholders. So during that meeting, they were trying to get people's points of view. I think everyone basically had a number of comments about it, but overall, one of the big themes was people wanted to see things be simplified. Now, if they can achieve that, great. The other thing they mentioned was there was simplification because there was a lot of complexity in the rules. Some of the investors and some of the companies questioned the materiality of the disclosures that were being put forward and the lack of flexibility in how disclosures have to be put together. So, you know, companies made these comments. Some companies have been making comments about this for years, pretty much since the rules were put in place. Now, they received over 1,000 comment letters, but it was open-ended. There was no direction. And so we're at the point where we think the SEC is going to take action in 26. And a matter of fact, it's on the regulatory agenda for Q1. We've heard some rumors that the SEC is actually actively drafting things. We don't exactly know what that means. I think we can anticipate likely a concept release sometime in early 26, followed by a comment process again, and then with some final rules that will come out. I would expect, if they're trying to fast track this, third, fourth, or early fourth quarter of 26. And I would then anticipate they could start applying for the 2027 proxy year.
And Ed, you mentioned a lot of the areas of simplification that have been discussed. I think in the comments that the SEC has received, there's a wide variety of ideas that have been floated, a handful of which seem to be universally accepted, some areas where almost every commentator has mentioned them as an area that could be considered for improvement, simplification, some other areas that maybe are a little bit more unique. So we could speculate, obviously, as to what may come out, but I think everyone is probably in agreement that it's going to be material. We're going to see some material changes in the rules, and it's really just how significant they are. They could be quite radical. They could be just more in line with, I think, what expectations are, which are still pretty material. But maybe walk through some of those things where there's been a lot of, I guess, agreement, at least among the commentators, of areas that could be simplified.
I think it's not very surprising, but a lot of the comment letters focused on disclosures that investors and the companies didn't see a lot of value in having in the proxies. And specifically, the one I think everyone sort of loves to hate, there's two, the PVP, pay versus performance disclosure, and the CEO pay ratio. Now, it's important to note those two disclosures are required under the Dodd-Frank Act. So the SEC can't wave a magic wand and make them completely go away. So those requirements are there under the Act. However, the Act gives the SEC a lot of authority to interpret how and what those rules actually have to say. So the rules we have currently introduce compensation actually paid for the PVP table and disclosure. So theoretically, the SEC could decide we're going to change this to make it less of a burden. They could look to see, okay, we already have a total amount. So if we don't think that's quite right, we could use other elements from like the summary comp table and the options exercised and stock vested table, perhaps, and put that together to say, okay, this is your compensation you received, and therefore this is what you should use. So that's a much easier thing to do rather than try and calculate out values for outstanding equity awards, which arguably may not necessarily have a bearing on things. From a grant practice standpoint, I think most companies focus on equity awards when they're granted. And then they may, after the fact, look to see how did we pay it out? If it was performance-based, how did we do on that cycle? But I don't know too many companies that are always looking at an interim basis of how is that award and what does that do for the total pay being delivered? That's not necessarily a concept I think most companies use. Now, I think most companies have the concept of realized and realizable pay. And so far, the disclosure rules don't necessarily require that type of disclosure. It's very perfunctory and dictated what has to be there, but it doesn't fall in either one of those buckets squarely.
Yeah. And we've also seen some comments that are maybe a little bit more significant, like, for example, just even the reduction in the number of named officers that might have to be disclosed,
right,
or who's considered to be a named officer. Changes to the summary compensation table could be more material if that's also on the list of SEC actions.
And the chair has made comments to that effect that it might be appropriate to evaluate that. And there's this question of smaller issuers. Well, right now, we have a system where large public companies have one set of disclosure rules. Smaller issuers have a scaled down disclosure requirement. Typically, that's three executive officers, CEO, CFO, and then the next highest paid executive gets put into their tables. Is that going to be lifted up and made standard for all companies? And then for the smaller companies, is it just CEO, CFO? I could see them doing something like that to make it more streamlined.
I think it's definitely on the table. We'll see where things come out, but could have a pretty significant impact, I think, to the way compensation committees operate and think about pay design. I think most committees out there are designing pay with a focus on driving their business and aligning their executives to the business outcomes. But clearly, disclosure has always had an impact. There's always that question of how is this going to be disclosed? How is it going to be perceived? So anytime that you make a material change to what and how you disclose things, it's at least going to have an influence on design and may not happen immediately. It may take a few years for us to really look back and be able to appreciate what impact these changes might have on design, but I'm sure they will have some impact.
I think they will. To a large extent, I think it depends on the nature and the quantity of the changes. If there are significant, as some folks speculate, it could be a wholesale change. And therefore, I think it would have a larger impact on the design process.
So let's shift a little bit. What we were just talking about, a little bit of it's obviously speculation. We don't have any rules yet, and hopefully those will be coming out in the next few months. But let's talk a little bit about the proxy advisors. So 2025 has been an interesting year. The proxy advisors have been under increasing scrutiny. There's been some House hearings. There's been regulatory bodies that have been looking at the proxy advisors. There's been even rumors that the administration could take executive actions. Maybe just real quickly recap for us what the year has been like from a scrutiny perspective. And then I want to get into some of those policy changes, because again, both ISS and Glass Lewis recently announced policy changes. And while they do that every year, this year felt like they were maybe a little bit more significant than what we've seen in recent years. So I want to walk through those together.
I think where we have to start from is the perspective that for proxy advisors, this is Trump administration 2.0. In 1.0, they came under attack, right? And they had rules drafted against them that were seriously going to cause them to have to make huge changes to their business model. And ultimately, those were thrown out by a court. Now, Trump 2.0, that administration, they're focused on this again quite a bit. As you said, we've got the rumors of potentially executive orders being thrown out there. We've got the potential of an FTC investigation going on of the proxy advisors. We even now have some of the states like Texas came in and passed a law that would regulate any proxy voting guidance that is not financial numbers based alone. So for ISS and Glass Lewis, they typically look at things more than just financials in coming to their vote recommendations. So they both sued the state of Texas, and it stayed pending the outcome of the court hearing on this, which I think is scheduled for February or March of 26. So that's a background we're operating in. They've had much higher scrutiny, and that I think has influenced how they've approached things. So for ISS, probably the more prevalent proxy advisor for most companies, they did a couple things to try and make things from their perspective a little bit better and more in line with what their investors are telling them, which is they want to see a longer term focus on pay for performance. So in their evaluation of pay for performance on their relative degree of alignment, which measures relative TSR versus relative CEO pay, ISS has announced it's going to move away from a 3-year look to a 5-year look. And that could have some implications for pay design. It could have implications for TSR, because typically there's not much a company can do to influence the TSR in and of itself. So it's one of those things I think companies have to be cognizant of. And when we look back from 5 years, that's likely just before the pandemic hit. So that in 26 will be an influence on the TSR numbers that ISS reports. And it could have an influence on the RDA, because during that 5-year period, the CEO pay, that's a time when the pandemic had some issues that had to be worked through on the comp side. So there were certain things done that weren't ordinary, and that could have inflated comp in the earlier part of that 5-year period. The other thing they're doing on their multiple of median test, they're moving from 1 year to a 1 and 3 year look. They announced this change several years back. Their reports have been reporting 1 and 3 year multiple of median. So it's not as large of a switch for them, but it's still going to be factored into the quantitative score now going forward. I will note that the pay TSR alignment, the third test that's typically applied by ISS, has always been 5 years that they look back on. The change to the RDA to 5 years from 3 years makes it more consistent with the existing pay TSR test. And I think companies need to be aware of this change, but I don't know that there's much you can do at this point in time, given that they're going to suddenly switch to a 5-year look back, other than just be cognizant of where you rank on TSR and where you rank on the CEO pay over the past 5 years. The other thing that was more interesting, I think, and it's gotten a little bit of coverage, is with in regards to their qualitative assessment of pay for performance analysis. And so when they're doing that now, it used to be where ISS would only consider performance-based pay as being performance. Now they've indicated, look, if you have a longer term time and retention for an award, that might be okay. Their FAQs came out earlier this week, and they basically indicate at least a minimum of 5 years vesting and required retention post-vesting might be enough. The problem I see with this right now, it's twofold. One, we don't have any examples of what's acceptable to ISS. We don't have any ISS reports that indicate what levels are good. It's an unknown whether or not 100% time-based vesting will be acceptable. It could be, but right now we just don't know. The other thing I think people need to be aware of as they're thinking about their designs for 26 and then 27 and onwards is what's the typical tenure of a CEO? Over the past several years, that's been sort of shifting down. I think right now for S&P 500, it's between 5 and 6 years, the last set of numbers I saw. So that would suggest moving and increasing your vesting period from a typical 3-year period for performance-based awards to a 5-year period for these new time-based awards might run into some issues. And at the very least would suggest you'd have to then look at your termination provisions in some detail to ensure you're getting the right result that the company wants going out the door.
Yeah. And maybe just to pause on this particular policy update, at least on paper, it would appear to be the one that could potentially have the most impact. But as you mentioned, Ed, we don't really have enough information yet to know exactly how they're going to view it. But if I think over the last 15 years, it's one of a handful of ISS policies that has really driven design, probably more than most. Because if you think back 15, 20 years ago, PSUs, they were a thing. They were something that companies did, but it was a much lower prevalence. Of course, stock options were much more popular. And with ISS really pushing that the only thing that they were going to be considering to be performance-based were PSUs, and that they really needed to be at least 50% of your mix for it to be considered at the level that they feel is acceptable, it's driven the market that direction. And we're at a point now where, at least among large public companies, it's almost universal that PSUs are part of the mix. And for the vast majority, it's at least 50%. Again, in theory now, if ISS is maybe loosening up a little bit there and saying, maybe we will consider long vested, 5-year vested, restricted stock or even stock options as being performance-based, that's going to cause, I think, a lot of companies to at least talk about this and say, were we driven maybe further to the PSU category than we would have been otherwise if we didn't have the proxy advisors pushing us that direction? But back to your point, we just don't have a lot of guidance. Like, what's the right mix that would be acceptable? Just a lot of that is still unknown. So until either companies maybe step out and take action and see what the reactions are, or unless we get more information, it's a little bit vague.
I agree on that point. There have been companies that have historically kept with time-based vesting because they said, look, we don't care what ISS says. We think this is best for us. Yep. And they've had 5 or 7 year vesting on equity. So I think those are going to be the immediate test cases for us. So looking at how they fare under this new ISS analysis, I think will help inform everyone else what will work and what won't. And that will help at least give us an idea of where the field is and what we can do with design.
We talked a bit about ISS, and there are other policies we could talk about, but maybe just shifting gears to Glass Lewis, because they also made a few policy changes, one in particular, which is, at least again, on its face, seems significant. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, on its face, for 2027, I think is the one you're alluding to, they announced we're no longer going to make our benchmark reports. We're going to have our clients with individualized, basically proxy voting policies, and we're going to issue 4 separate reports. This is similar to what ISS did a few years back. So I'm a bit skeptical that this is going to really have a huge impact on the way Glass Lewis is viewed in the market. To the extent that they have a standardized policy and proxy voting guidelines, I don't think it's going to really change anything too much. Because I think when they're helping their clients figure out what are your proxy voting guidelines, it's largely going to have to start somewhere. And very few of their clients necessarily have their own voting guidelines. So what are they going to do? They're going to go reach to their basic guidelines that they already have and say, all right, what do you want to tweak here? So there might be some sort of differences at the margins, but I think by and large, it's still going to look and feel much like the current Glass Lewis proxy voting guidelines today. But we have to, again, wait and see on that one. The other development from Glass Lewis is on their pay for performance. Again, like ISS, they announced that they're moving away from the 3-year to a 5-year look. So with both ISS and Glass Lewis moving to a 5-year analysis for pay for performance, that's going to be, I think, one that companies have to take into account. Glass Lewis also is moving away from its traditional sort of one single formulaic approach, which spit out a letter grade, A through F, and they're going to go with a numerical grade, 0 through 100. Okay. Your guess on how they're going to actually calculate this is as good as mine, because they've announced 5 separate tests of what they're looking at. And some of them are interesting. They call on the existing structure that they're using and the existing test, but they're looking at like CEO granted pay versus TSR and financial performance. Right now, it's mainly against financial performance on a relative basis against the Glass Lewis peers. They also want to look at NEO granted pay versus only financial performance, again, relative to the identified Glass Lewis peers. Then this is a new one, the CEO STI payouts. So annual incentive payouts versus TSR. And then they're delving into the PVP table, assuming it still exists and still has compensation actually paid. They want to look at CEO compensation actually paid versus TSR. And for those last two tests, they're going to use market-based benchmarks for STI payouts versus TSR and market capitalization peers for cap versus TSR. So right now, while we know what they say, you know, this is the test we're using, we don't know in practice yet how they're going to apply that, what they're looking for, what's quote unquote good and what's bad. So this is another one we're going to have to wait and see where things settle out.
So some interesting developments on the advisor front. Again, they always make updates to their policies at the end of each year, but this year just feels like a maybe a little bit more aggressive changes. And I think some of it reacting to just the continued pressure that they find themselves under. So maybe just one last quick topic, Ed, as we think about 26 and different things that may be on the committee agenda, committee discussion. When we started earlier this year, it looked like tariffs were going to be a major impact on the economy, and they have had a significant impact. As far as companies, it really, I think it's an industry by industry impact. Some have seen major impacts through the tariffs, others less, and some companies have been able to adapt better than others. But this is something that is going to stretch into 2026. So maybe just talk a little bit about how you think that that's going to impact 26 and maybe some of the committee discussions going on.
Yeah, I think you've got two discussions, right? You have one on how does this influence the payout discussion for 2025? Does it at all? I think for a lot of the clients I've worked with, the tariffs wasn't necessarily a known quantity at the beginning of the year when they set goals. So to the extent that that company is in an industry that was hit hard by the tariffs, one would think there's going to be some type of forgiveness, at least for rank and file folks. Whether that extends up to the executive team, that's going to be facts and circumstances. And I could see it happening in some cases and not in others. I think the tariff impact is dependent upon the industry. As you mentioned, some industries are heavily dependent upon imports. To the extent that they are, that's going to probably hit their business much harder than others. The ones I know that have been hit hard are retail in particular. So for those companies, if they're importing things, it's not just from China, it's also from Canada. I have one client that is importing things from Canada, and that's a significant piece of the tariff impact. So they're going to have to figure out how does that impact the payouts for 2025? And then to the extent that they can quantify what's the tariff impact for 2026 on a go-forward basis, how do you bake that into the goals? And here's the sort of the little bird we don't know what's going to happen on. There's been lawsuits about the tariffs. If those lawsuits come out and say, no, the tariffs were illegal, you have to refund all the money, then you have to, I think, set goals for 2026 that are flexible enough to say, okay, if tariffs are applied, here's what we do. If tariffs end up being reversed and not applicable, here's what we do. Because otherwise, you could be in a situation where you've gone with the notion that tariffs will apply. At the end of the year, they're gone, and you might have a windfall. So I think planning for that up front would make a lot of sense, especially in industries that are impacted by tariffs.
Yeah, this could be a year that you see companies have more than one performance curve based on potential outcomes. Thanks, Ed. I think this has been a really interesting, good conversation. As we said at the beginning of the conversation, 2026 is shaping up to be a pretty pivotal, interesting year. A lot of unknowns still at this point, but we'll definitely be in a year where we, I think, see changes and see a lot of actions by committees. So thanks for joining the podcast.
Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you for joining us on the Executive Compensation Podcast. For deeper insights into executive pay, governance trends, and board advisory best practices, visit meridiancp.com. Meridian Compensation Partners, LLC, guiding boards and leadership teams with clarity, confidence, and independent advice.